couple of members.
Senate File 1436, MSOP provisions modifications. The only thing, do I have a fiscal note? I was looking for it. The only thing that brings us here really is the contracting for national expert advice in how to track and run the best treatment program for sex offenders that we can. I think that, you know, everybody realizes we need to do as good a job as we can and need to constantly review how we're doing, and a team of national experts to do that under contract would be a really wise addition to the MSOP program. We do have a fiscal note that basically says the agency can absorb this contracting piece. It's something that they currently do, really. They've been working on and understood that they needed to do this. This is the legislative authority for that. And so the fiscal note really shows no net cost to the state.
Are there any questions? Okay, do you want to move your bill?
So, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 1436 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Senator Lori, you're doing the presentation on Senate File 1229, and I think at this moment I think I would just announce that item number 7 on the agenda is being deleted.
Yeah, this is Senate File 1229. It is the PCA redesign. This was and is Yvonne Pretner-Solon's bill. And I'll kind of give just a little bit of background on how we're here. Yvonne got to working on the OLA report. I think everybody's pretty familiar that the OLA highlighted some program integrity issues we needed to work on in the PCA program in general. And Yvonne's been working very hard on that. Had not included much of the cuts to the program that the governor had recommended. If members will recall, we did get an update on the governor's budget that had $40 million of savings built into it. As we listened to that, one of the things that really troubled myself and a good number of the members was that under that proposal, there was a 2 ADL threshold for access into PCA services, and that the lion's share of those of the 2,000 people who would have fallen off of eligibility for that program were mental health clients that were currently receiving PCA services and used those services to maintain their living status in the community, and that these people would likely wind up somewhere else in the system, and we wouldn't actually recognize those savings. So we got to work with a team. DHS was incredibly helpful at working with us and helping us understand who those 2,000-plus clients were, so that we could try to – our first attempt was to try to find some other service to wrap around these mental health clients to make sure that we didn't destabilize the homes. And we fairly quickly determined that there really wasn't another appropriate service that would help maintain the stability of the homes, because all of the other that would allow us to continue drawing down the federal funds for these services. So in the next 2 years, we'd be stuck with only about 40% of the available funds to support these individuals, and we just couldn't build a service with that shackling of our financial resources to get that done. So what we decided was the new service to wrap around these 2,000-plus individuals would be PCA still, and try to take the PCA redesign kind of in two steps. And the first step would be to, rather than the straight-out 2 ADL threshold for entrance, we would use 1 ADL or a level 1 behavior need and for the entrance into the program. And that dropped us from 2,000 clients dropping off of PCA to about 500 clients dropping off. And those 500 clients would have 0 ADLs and something shy of level one behavior needs, and you know, it was hard to get much beyond that. We needed to. It was recognized that we needed to book significant savings under the redesign. I think I mentioned the governor's initial plan had about $40 million of savings in the current biennium, in the biennium we're working on. And through this redesign, we were able to achieve 30.25 million of savings still in the PCA redesign, and we have a long-term plan to still get to two ADLs because as the threshold, but we need to build this other service. And there are some other options on the table. The feds have, in the 2007 Deficit Reduction Act, have created a 1915I waiver program that a lot of the national mental health advocates have been looking at as a good option for targeting mental health clients that need a service, something like this, and it's fairly flexible. But we didn't have time to fully develop that and work on it, so we used this measure and fully anticipate to work forward and get to that 2-ADL threshold quickly. Now, I have a delete all amendment, the A6 amendment to 1229, and I hope members have that. I don't know. If not, it can be distributed. And this is, so Yvonne was working on program integrity. Senator Pretner-Solon was working on the program integrity piece, and I was working on the fiscal piece, trying to find a service so that we didn't destabilize these 2,000 individuals. And as we kept working, we were talking together a bit, but we thought we were going to run separate tracks. But because the redesign required an entirely new codification of the PCA statutes, we really kind of needed to merge these two together and bring the savings components into one amendment. So this is the A6 amendment that includes both, and it is pretty much what Yvonne and Ann Henry presented a couple days ago on the program integrity pieces, and then I will just highlight the fiscal pieces that were added, and there is a fiscal advisory for the A6 amendment, and I'll kind of step you through what the pieces of it are. Really, there was, in the governor's plan, there was reduced hours for PCA clients through a restructuring of the home care rating system, going from 21 home care ratings down to 10, and utilizing the median rate for the new home care ratings, and then having add-ons for behavioral and for health complications and for ADLs that could add to the hours. We accepted those and incorporated those reduced hours through the restructuring of the home care ratings. We did change from the 2 ADL threshold to the 1 ADL or level 1 behavior, and that's where most of the lost savings are, but again, we did get to over $30 million of the governor's initial 40. If you want to look at this, the section 6 on page 3 and section 14, subdivision 9 on page 36 are where the 1 ADL or the level 1 behavior is kind of spelled out. We did, the governor had recommended requiring the responsible party to live with the PCA recipient. There's significant savings in that, and we reluctantly accepted that one, too. There's about $5 million in savings on that. You'll find that in Section 8 on page 5 in the definitions there. And then, oops, again, somewhere later on. Where did that go? Here it is in Section 14, subdivision 9 on page 36. Oh, that's where that one is. And the home care redesign is on page 26 in section 13. And then also the governor had recommended a cap of 310 hours for PCA providers per month. And we also accepted that. That has something about $5 million in the current biennium of savings there. So really that's, you know, the crux of it. I won't go over the program integrity issues, but we do have Ann Henry and Kathy Kelso here, that and DHS, and we really worked a good deal and have kind of a package that is still a painful one to bring forward. We understand these PCA services are a critical service for a good number of individuals, and we bring this forward with some reluctance, but I think that it is the best package that will get through the program integrity pieces recommended by the OLA and still recognize significant savings to help us with our budget targets for the biennium. With that, I would open it up for questions and do have folks from all of the agencies, all of the groups we worked with. Oh, before I open it up, let me also say that the plans, the health plans, have been engaging as of late, too, and they'd had some additional ideas. We're going to keep working on this. There might be some fine-tuning to be done. They're going to be providing some of their thoughts, but and our group has worked through them, and I believe that most of their concerns, they're very interested in the program integrity piece too, and we've worked through it and share many of the same goals, and a lot of that critical work is incorporated in here, but if we need a few additional fine-tuning pieces, we'll continue to work on those.
Senator Laurie, I guess the major concern I have about this package is that the tail savings are perhaps inadequate. And while you talk about intending to go to two ADLs, this doesn't actually ever do that. The language doesn't ever do that.
We looked at, again, we started by trying to find another service to wrap around these individuals so as not to destabilize the homes. Drafting a new waiver became pretty complicated, and it is a task that was going to take longer than the time we had. You know, it's possible we could try to estimate and draft some language around what it would take and set some fiscal targets and put if we needed to, put a placeholder in there so that we had some money set aside to do those service. I mean, we do have a commitment. And you're right, there is, you know, the governor's initial plan for the reduced hours and the two ADL thresholds alone, those two segments, would have had about $60.2 million in savings in the tails, whereas if we don't say that we're going to get to two ADLs in fiscal year 2012, we recognize $40.2 million in savings in the tails. You know, I think that's a pretty good incentive for us to get to work on this if we don't, you know, if we don't run into significant tails problems in putting together our bill. Our preference would be to leave it like that and give us the flexibility to design this new program over the interim and come back next year. If we have significant tails targets, there are some options we have available to try and take a stab at defining what this service would be and set aside some money in the tracking sheets to implement those new services. I mean, we can work on that, but what we've brought forward today does not incorporate what that new service would be. You're right, Madam Chair.
So I just want to make people aware of the fact that we may be needing to do some more work on this because of the tails issues. Any other questions about the A6 amendment? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Laurie. Senator Laurie, can you talk a little bit more about the required responsible party to live in? If you could refer me to where that is in the bill and what the means in terms of how is this proposal different from what is currently in law in that area.
Yeah, and I might ask either Ann Henry or Alex Bartolik, Ann Henry from the advocate side or Alex Bartolik from DHS to come and help me out with this. It's in Section 14, Subdivision 9 on page 36 or Pam Urkel from the department, I guess, is really the main place where the responsibility party is responsible party has discussed. And the change from current law is that the responsible party really does not have to live with the PCA recipient right now. And, you know, this is, we used to require the responsible party to live with the PCA recipient for a long time. This is a tough one because people have changed the way they live and don't have their responsible parties living with them right now. But with some of the program integrity issues identified, there's a real push to make sure that that responsible party who understands the client and their needs is right there with the client, making sure that that the services are appropriate and assisting with the client. But here's Pam Urkel from the department.
Members of the committee, my name is Pam Urkel. I work with the Department of Human Members of the committee, my name is Pam Urkel, and I work with the Department of Human Services in the Disability Services Division. Excuse me. Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, responsible party back since the beginning of this program was required to live with a recipient if they could not direct their own care. So it doesn't apply to everybody who receives personal care services. It only applies to people who cannot direct their own care, which makes them more vulnerable than otherwise if they could direct their care. So the responsible party's duty is really to assure that the personal care attendant is completing the care plan, is making sure that the services are being delivered the way they need to be delivered, that the timesheets are signed appropriately, and that the person is really getting good care from the responsible party's perspective. So it really does not apply across the board to everybody who receives personal care services. And it was until in the 2000, 2001, sometime in this decade, that we changed it to responsible parties didn't have to live with a person who couldn't direct their own care, but they still had to be involved. The bill that's before you right now, or the amendment that's before you right now, and what was in the governor's package, not only required the responsible party to live again with the person who could not direct their own care, but also really defines very clearly in statute now what exactly the responsible party's duties are, including having a written agreement with the provider and the PCA in order to make sure that those duties of the responsible party are fulfilled.
Madam Chair, Ann Henry would also like to talk about this provision a little bit. This one is, you know, going to cause some problems. And, yes, the person who cannot direct their own care, I always think of them as their own. The person who can direct their own care, I just think of them as their own responsible party. So Pam gave a more accurate description. But Ann Henry would also like to.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ann Henry. I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I thought it would be a good idea to just draw this out a little bit because I'm sure some of you will hear from people affected by this and maybe try to understand what the situations are. We have a number of people with disabilities, adults who have quite significant disabilities who are living at home and being taken care of, at least in the numbers of cases I know, largely by a single mother, an aging single mother, clearly, because they've got an adult at home. And because the person with a disability is an adult, it is okay for that parent of an adult to be paid as a PCA. So it isn't exactly correct to say they're without guidance and care and somebody worrying about their well-being. They definitely are. They're living there with their mother who is being paid for some hours of PCA but providing a whole lot of other hours of care without any compensation at all. And this will force a change somehow in that situation. And I think one of the most unfortunate things about the proposal is that we don't have an analysis of the interaction between disability and poverty, and what happens to families. Because obviously this mother, usually, who's taking care of this person is not able to be employed outside the home. There's a lot of problems to be sure the PCA shows up, et cetera. So This is the income that's being used to pay, and it's the situation in different places across the state. So you may hear from some situations like that. It also affects the elderly because those folks, whether they need a responsible party or not, is often a little difficult as folks decline. And at what point do you say they can't manage anymore? So people are in their own, like, public housing apartment, one bedroom, and they do have PCA service. They cannot move somebody else in. That would be illegal. And they're not going to have the money to move somewhere else and lose that public housing subsidy. We hope that we can figure out some alternatives if this comes to pass, but I think it will cause some significant disruption to people that you'll hear from. Thank you.
One thing on the responsible party, it is the assessments will start in January of 2010, but I don't think anybody would be forced to have that responsible party live until there, until June of 2010. So there is a one-year delay to help us try to mitigate some of the problems that are real in this particular change.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about another provision on line 38.22, page 38, which has to do with the number of hours a person can be paid for. It's limited to 310 hours per month. And, you know, I understand if we're looking at trying to weigh the need for these services versus the cost of having someone taken care of somewhere else where the cost might be much more expensive, and the need to not be paying for people who might be misusing the system or paid for things that really are not included under the list of things that are intended to be covered or for something a family member would be doing anyway. And it just strikes me that I just have a couple of comments. I mean, if you were talking about a four-week month, you're talking about somebody who's being paid to work, you know, what, 70, 75 hours a week. I just kind of question whether someone's really putting in that much time doing the things that are specifically listed here. Now, maybe it's a little bit more reasonable if you have a five-week month. It seems maybe it would be a better idea to list the limitation by the week. It would make more sense because by the month it's going to fluctuate. And I just see it just seems like an awful lot of hours to expect someone to actually be working.
I think the mechanics of Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think the mechanics of going to a weekly one is a little difficult because they do roll up the billings on a monthly basis, and so there's a mechanical problem going to a weekly. And I'm going to let Ann Henry speak to the issues of why a 310-hour week, where, you know, you calculate it out, if it's 31-day month, yeah, it's 10 hours a day, 7 days a week throughout the whole month. And that sounds like a lot, and who's going to be working that, but there are some real families that do utilize that, and it is actually helping them maintain a home in the community that to restrict that further would destabilize that home again. And I'm gonna let Ann speak more directly to this if you would.
Ms. Henry.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think let me just give you an example of a situation like this. When you have a serious injury of an adult, say a family with children, we've had several families like this, the spouse would like to take care of the family and keep the kids in the family home. In order to be able to do that, people have to get divorced because the spouse cannot be paid as a PCA. And that has happened. But so the spouse is providing all the care to avoid high-level institutionalization and still maintain the children in the home. The other situations that I'm told occur, and I'm sure this is true, is that because the wages that PCAs make are not adequate to make a living, a lot of people have more than one job and care for more than one person. And I think this issue could maybe have more targeted change if we had some data. And it, I think that when this change goes in, we should be able to begin to get more information about the folks who are in this situation and what to do about it. But I think at this point, it was the first time an hour limit came in. And it's very clear there are people now, for instance, who are being cared for with 14 hours of PCA service a day, and they're going to be cut at least by 2 hours a day and maybe more. So I think the hours cut is also going to affect how many hours a PCA works, because the person isn't going to have that many hours anymore for the PCA to be employed. So there are these factors interact, and I think that within a year we may better know what is happening here.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Well, I appreciate that, and I realize you're trying to imagine how all this is going to affect the way that people are using this program today and try to cause as little harm as possible. But I just still have to say that I have a problem, or I could say an objection. I don't agree with the idea of paying someone for 310 hours of work per month under this program. Now, someone may need 310 hours of care, and perhaps we should be paying for that, but that's different than paying someone for 310 hours of work as a PCA, that one person. And I just question whether a person's really capable of doing that and be performing the duties we're supposed to be paying for all of this time. And so, you know, if we're really just trying to find a way to subsidize the finances of a family in this situation, that's a different issue. And maybe another a worthwhile issue to consider. But we are trying to avoid the misuse of this program and make sure it's only being used for the work that we're paying for here.
Are there other questions? Senator Lori, your amendment doesn't even authorize the department to apply for this 1915I waiver. I mean, I think we should at least have that language in here so we have some idea what direction we're heading. I think maybe Mr. Gill can help us do that.
Madam Chair, I was going to consult with the department on what we would need for that. I haven't done it now, but we have it to fold in when the bill is put together next week.
I'd be fine with that. I mean,
so I guess we don't have it ready, but I think it should be included in here.
Done while it's on the table, too, I would imagine. I mean, I wouldn't have any objection.
Any other questions? If not, the A6 amendment is before us. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Any other questions or discussion on this issue? Then we'll set this aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill with the understanding that we aren't done working on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
right, we'll move on to item number four, Senate File 1442, Alternative Basic Health Plan for Families with Children Eligible for MA Establishment.
Thank you, Madam Welcome. Chair and members of the committee. Really, the reason for putting this on the agenda today is because I know that there are people on this division who feel that it's important for us to be trying to sculpt down our benefits a little bit in our programs during this time of financial difficulty. And this bill was an effort to do that. But it turns out that it really isn't going to be possible for the department to fiscal note this bill because of the limited amount of data that's available for the parents that would be possibly using these services within our PMAP program. And so we have included that memo in your packet so you can review it. And so this would also require the department to seek a waiver. We did model this after Idaho's program, so we thought it might be easier for them to get a waiver. But I think it would be difficult for them to get a waiver if we can't even show cost effectiveness because we can't get the data. So for that reason, I'm not going to be pursuing this bill. And I just wanted people to know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it was a good concept to entertain and spend some time on, and we'll have to continue to that end. Any questions or comments from members? Okay. Senator Berglund, please continue.
Madam Chair, the next item on the agenda is KC007 amendment.
Members, that amendment's being distributed. KC0007. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members, I would move the amendment to put it before us. And the idea behind this is really to ask for our Department of Human Services to be implementing a payment reform demonstration project that would implement value-based purchasing concepts. And this is being done in the private sector today, and we believe that we could have value in having this done in our public programs as well. We would need to get a waiver to do it in our fee-for-service programs. But we believe that it could be implemented for people with chronic conditions in our PMAP program and in our general assistance medical care program without a waiver. So the amendment outlines the process that the commissioner would go through in terms of seeking bids from providers and coming up with financial arrangements, and then we would anticipate that we would begin using this value-based purchasing system by January 1st of 2010. And we know that one of the areas that we have had success in the state already without even asking people to do it is in the area of chronic cardiac care. We've had a project in Duluth, and we've had a project by the Park Nicollet system in regard to people with chronic cardiac care receiving daily phone calls from nurse practitioners, and through that mechanism they were able to reduce hospitalizations by 80%. And so we have included this as one of the things that has to be part of what an organization would have in their proposal when they present it to the Department of Human Services. And then we go on in here to indicate that after the first year of voluntary proposals coming forward, that for the second year we would be purchasing this chronic cardiac care only by people who would be providing this mechanism of providing the care. And the reason for that really is because we know that people who have chronic cardiac conditions today are very much at risk of being hospitalized and having their life shortened. And we know that we can provide this better care for them. And so to wait until everybody who might want to volunteer does so would really be a disservice to our patients. And so that is why that is in here. The bill also allows the commissioner to consult with the Health Services Policy Committee and the Commissioner of Health about other baskets of care that they might want to recommend to the legislature in the future as ways that we would be required to purchase care for our clients. And that's basically an outline of the idea.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I assume this is essentially the same proposal that we spent quite a bit of time talking about last year and that was originally in the healthcare reform proposal, except that it's in the form of more of a voluntary demonstration project as opposed to an across-the-board requirement. But is that the case?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I would say it builds on the reform work that we did last session. But I would say that it is different than what was proposed last session, because what was proposed last session was that there would be total cost of care required in a year certain for everybody. And this isn't doing that. This is allowing providers to come forward with total cost of care for various populations rather than requiring that they do it for everybody who has a chronic disease. And it is voluntary, except that in the second year, we would be requiring people who are providing chronic cardiac care to be providing the care through this mechanism, because we get such better outcomes for our patients that it would be unfair to them to continue to provide the kind of care that we do today.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, and I noticed that there's an attempt, at least in the bill, to address some of the concerns that I've expressed with this concept before. For example, when you have an outcome-based sort of value-oriented system, you have sometimes a conflict of interest between the person providing the services and the amount that they'll spend on that person versus, and that's kind of inherent in our managed healthcare system. And then when you're reviewing your outcomes, different populations are just naturally, likely, predictably going to have different outcomes than other populations. And I see that you're directing the commissioner to try to implement a rich risk adjustment mechanism to adjust for that. But I think we're still adding another level of administrative cost and tracking to a system. And I'd just be real interested to know if the hospitals generally, if they're still as opposed to going in this direction as they were last year, or if there's been...
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this is voluntary, so nobody has to do it if they don't want to. But the advantage here is that it is a proposal that is put together on a shared savings basis. So first of all, the commissioner wouldn't accept a proposal that wasn't going to demonstrate or expect to have some savings. And then the state would benefit from some of the savings, and the providers involved in the proposal would benefit from some of the savings. So in this environment where the alternative is just cut people's rates, it would seem to me this would be more attractive than it might have been in the past.
And particularly in the area of cardiac care, we, you know, I remember very clearly the evidence and the illustrations that St. Mary's Duluth presented on this issue, I think, at least two times in this division over the last couple of years. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I know it's voluntary, but on the cardiac care, do we have to get a federal waiver for that?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, we have to get a waiver for our fee-for-service program to do this at all. And so we would be looking for the department to try to do that. But we believe that in our general assistance medical care program, because there are no federal dollars, and in our managed care program, our PMAP program, that we can go ahead and do this without a waiver. And I expect, based on what we'll be able to show them in regard to what we're doing there, getting a waiver for our fee-for-service population won't be that difficult.
Any further questions from the committee? We will set that aside.
Yes, I would ask that this be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Move on to the next amendment. I believe it deals with prior authorization. That is amendment SC6981. It's being distributed.
Madam Chair and members
Senator
of the
Berger.
Committee, this is a late idea that was brought to me by an organization that helps states manage their fee-for-service population in these areas of imaging and ultrasound and other technology areas. They have a mechanism where the provider can call and instantly get an approval or a disapproval, and they have indicated quite a bit of savings to other states, and they're able to structure a contract in such a way that it's a capitated rate for the service, so the payment of the contract fee comes out of the savings that are generated by the program. And so I thought this idea might have some potential and would be something that we might want to include in our omnibus bill as well.
Okay. Questions from members? Senator Olson, are you asking a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just so... Who does this apply to? I see in subdivision.
This would be our Medicaid fee-for-service population. So it wouldn't apply to any of our managed care populations, only to those populations that are not being managed currently.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund, I notice it doesn't say anything about just a straight x-ray in terms of services that are listed, but it does say all diagnostic imaging services, which would seem to include an x-ray. And
I don't think they're doing prior authorization for x-rays because that's a pretty low-cost service. It's these imaging services that are more high cost and sometimes are overutilized by providers.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I understand that may be the case in terms of how things are operating now, but I'm just saying the way this is drafted would appear to require prior authorization for an x-ray, even though it's not specifically listed, but it just says only including. It says outpatient diagnostic imaging services, which I would assume would include an x-ray, And then it goes on to say including, but it doesn't say specifically that it has to be one of these things. So,
the Chair, I just
Senator Berglund.
Council, if this needs to be clarified.
Ms. Kavanaugh.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think to make it clear on line one or page one, line nine, after four, insert the following, and then on line 10, after services, insert a colon and then remove including.
So I would incorporate that into the amendment.
Thank you. Any additional questions or comments? All right, Senator Berglund.
So if there are no other questions, I just set that aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, we'll move on to the next item for discussion. Members, this is being distributed as SC6984, dealing with eligible vendors of medical care. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the division, this is another idea that builds on the health care reform that we passed last year. And we now have work going on to create peer grouping systems for providers based on their cost and quality of care. And this language would direct the Department of Human Services, effective January 1st of 2011, to not include providers in our network who would be in the high cost, low quality tier. It would give the commissioner authority to waive that requirement in cases where there might be problems that could develop related to access. So what would happen under this proposal then is providers who are in the high cost, low quality tier would have the opportunity to reduce their utilization to get themselves in a lower tier and remain in the program. Or patients would go to other providers who are exhibiting lower utilization trends and thereby are in a lower cost, higher quality tier.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Berglund. The concern I have with moving in this direction, again, you know, we talked about this last year, but we had testimony in some of the subcommittees that we had on under the Healthcare Access Commission and in another group as well that some of the providers who are identified by their peers as being of the highest quality were still not scoring well under these kinds of systems as far as the insurance company was concerned when under their kind of scoring system. And it might have been because they were providing the extra time with the patient that they felt the patient needed. Because so when you're talking about value, from the medical community standpoint, there may be a difference in how they're looking at value as compared to how the insurance industry was looking at value. And so there was a lot of concern and skepticism about moving in this direction, and I guess I just would like to state that I share that concern.
Well,
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this is the direction we're moving because of the health care reform legislation last session. I can tell you that while we do not rank quality in our state employee healthcare program, we do tier based on cost, and the result has been much lower inflation than we've seen in our public healthcare programs. And I believe this is an important step for us to take in order to meet our TAILS target without doing something like possibly continuing to delay hospital rebasing. And, you know, when we cut reimbursement rates in our bills, which we will be doing this year, We cut low-cost providers as well as high-cost providers, and it's really not fair. And this will give us an opportunity to look at doing this differently in the future so that we can get savings that might be needed so that we don't have to cut rates to low-cost providers. And I think that would be an important reform step for us to take.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Berglund, or perhaps Council, could refresh my memory. Is the peer grouping system developed by the Commissioner of Health, do they look at qualifications every year on these groups, or is it?
It'll be at least every
Senator
year.
Berglund.
It might be every 6 months.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Berglund. What if it's the case that a particular organization that the commissioner has determined to be low quality and high cost for whatever the reasons might be the only provider That's available in a particular area?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, we give the commissioner the authority to exempt providers in that situation from being excluded.
All right, Senator Berglund. Senator Sharon.
In that situation, Senator Berglund, that there may be an area in the state where that's the provider, but they're high cost, low quality. Is there a way in the current system or in any way that we're moving that there can be some resistance or pushback to the cost of that provider?
Madam Chair
Senator Berglund.
And Senator Sharon, I believe there would be ways, there would be things we could do, but I don't think we're at a stage where we know enough to know what would be appropriate.
Okay, I don't see any further discussion, so we'll set that aside.
Ask for that to be set aside for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Our next item on the agenda is an amendment.
This would be item number 10.
I'm sorry, we're skipping item number 9, and we'll move to item number 10.
Madam Chair, that should be arriving momentarily, but not quite ready.
Okay, Mr. Gill.
And same for number 11.
And the same is true for number 11. So amendments for 10 and 11 are not ready at the moment.
I guess what we could do is we could look at the working paper for the fiscal note on these ideas, since we have them.
Members, those items are in your packets. Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, members, I just also wanted to inform you that there's an additional worksheet coming that's being copied at the moment for this package as well.
Madam Chair and members, we received word, about 2 weeks ago that the department felt that their nursing level of care proposal was not going to meet the requirements of the stimulus FMAP monies, and so we've been working with the department ever since then to try to come up with other ways to get savings during this 18-month period that we aren't going to be able to get savings off of that proposal, and so that's what these ideas are. One of them is an intervention to help people, certain people that have been identified as being having low ADL needs who remain in a nursing home for a period of time and continue to have low ADL needs, to do intervention to help them come back out of the nursing home. And there's a study done by the department and the University of Minnesota of these people, and there are a number of them that they don't get worse, but they just don't leave the nursing home, and it could be that they're not leaving and going back into the community because they need some extra help to do that.
And just members, and for the record, this is the DG0008A amendment that is being distributed.
So maybe I could get a copy of this amendment also.
It's always helpful.
G0008. Madam Chair? I'd just like
Mr.
to
Gill.
Mention that there are some amendments necessary to this amendment that the department has transmitted this morning. So if we act on this, we'll have to add those ways.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gill. Senator Berglund.
So just to walk through this amendment, this would be a service that would be provided by the Senior Linkage Line, and it would apply to Housing with Services as well as the intervention for people that are in nursing homes. And, you know, since I'm seeing this right now for the first time myself, it isn't like we haven't sat around and talked about it, but maybe I could get some help from the department in terms of going through this, because I'm not sure exactly what order all of these ideas are included in this amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I guess I'm a little confused why we did not meet the qualifications for the federal stimulus, and
okay.
Perhaps we could review that before we go on with the amendment.
Senator Berglund.
This was really disturbing to me, Madam Chair. Apparently there's some language in the stimulus law that says that you can't do anything during the time you're receiving the enhanced federal Medicaid monies that would be construed to limit access to institutional services. And so they believe that this would be able to be construed as limiting access to institutional services, because we would be changing the ADL requirement for entering. So working on some other ideas here to accomplish some savings that during this 18-month period. And I personally supported that governor's reform effort and had thought we would be including it in our bill. And when we were informed 2 weeks ago that we couldn't do it for 18 months, we lost savings that we were hoping to have. And so we've been working hard, and I think we've come up with some good ideas here, actually. And these are things that the department had been thinking about when they put their budget together, but some of these ideas didn't merit the investment once you were doing the other proposal. But now that we're not doing the other proposal until later, the investment is worth doing, we believe.
That was helpful. Thank you. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and Senators, my name is Krista Boston. I'm a Director for Consumer Assistance Programs for the Aging and Adult Services Division. I also operate the Senior Linkage Line as the State Director. So as the Senator indicated, this is an idea that we have been working on at the department for almost a year now, based on a report that was issued and contract work that was done with the Center on Aging at the University of Minnesota and under a subcontract to the Indiana University Center for Aging Research. Essentially what they did was they looked at a cohort of data from 2008-2007 and looked at persons in terms of their status, how long they had been in the nursing home, and whether or not they had returned to the community. And long and short of it is that nursing home admissions tend to range along a continuum from very high probability of community discharge to very low probability. Once you go into the nursing home and before 30 days, you have about a 60% chance of return to the community. Once you reach 180 days, it's about a 10% chance of returning to the community. But there is a small cohort of people in the facility that remain past about 90 days that when you compare them to their peers have already left. And this is about 2,500 people that we've looked at across the state. And we've also mapped this and found that it's in a variety of facilities across the state. And the other thing that the report did was issue a fiscal profile that would document and make available savings in the Medicaid program, both federal and state savings. And so that is the idea that we proposed at this time, was to have an intensive intervention that would offer discharge planning and assistance to these folks so that they can go back home. And we'll ramp that up from the day they enter the facility to 90 days and thereafter.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I've said this before in this committee, but our family had a personal experience with a relative who was treated in the hospital for a broken ankle and then went to a nursing home for what was supposed to be a temporary stay, fell out of bed the first night, broke her hip, and that was the end of ever a possibility of returning home. And we were told by the nursing home staff that that was a fairly common occurrence because of the lack of ability for there to be rails on a bed and someone in a smaller bed than they're used to in a strange place. And I just would have to say that if we're trying to look at getting people back home and reducing the length of time they stay in nursing homes, maybe it's time to reevaluate whether that is having the effect that it was intended to have when that law was passed.
Madam Chair, there are
Senator Berglund.
Also, we were looking at, the governor recommended that there be a requirement for two activities of daily living to be needed assistance with in order to be eligible for the elderly waiver program, and then create this separate pot of money that would be available for people with lower needs who are elderly. And we looked at that and said, you know, we thought we could create two parts to the elderly waiver program. One part where it would do what the governor had proposed, but the second part would be for people that have, you know, one activity of daily living that they need assistance with, and they would just get a lower level of service from the elderly waiver program. And in that way, we're not limiting people's access to Medicaid, and we would meet the requirements of the federal
stimulus
package, and we wouldn't lose the federal participation for those people with the lower ADLs. And so that language is in this bill also.
Senator Sharon, did you have a question?
Well, I was wondering if the department, as you talked about this 10%, I'm just curious what, very simply, you were able to discover about what this intensive set of services that you'll have to provide for discharge for alternative placement. What creates the phenomena that 10% stay in highly skilled nursing facilities when they're mirroring others who've left? What are you finding is the cause of that?
Ms. Boston.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, we did actually look at a number of these clients and reviewed the data, and it's very hard to determine what those factors are. It's a variety of factors. Many of these people are very low need, and so they really probably shouldn't be there. They appear to have recovered and could go home. They might need some help, just some help planning. Some of them may have already sold their homes, so that's an issue. And one of the things about this idea is that we would put in place a service that would interact with really all people that enter into a facility and let them know that there's help for discharge planning. So it might be just lack of information. So it's really a variety of factors. It's hard to pinpoint one particular driver that's making this happen.
Interesting. Senator Berglund. I don't see any further questions.
Maybe I can just ask a question, Mr. Giel. Is this A8 amendment both including the transitional consultation for people entering housing with services and the intervention for people in a nursing facility.
Mr. Gill.
It appears to be that to me, but.
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's the complete package.
Okay. I think the only other element here that we might not have mentioned is that we would be requiring people to be screened. Today, the screening is optional, and we have a lot of people that take advantage of it, but not everybody does. And so this proposal would also require that the screening take place before a person would be entering the nursing facility. And that's in order to identify these people that might be able to come back out and to inform people that in the future, these two ADLs are going to be a requirement to be in the nursing facility. And so that should be something that they think about when they make a decision about entering a nursing facility.
Senator Berglund, I would just say I know this was difficult news when you learned that we weren't going to be able to take the initial proposal that came forward. And I think we are all appreciative of the work that has went into putting this together. So thank you very much.
Well, and I just want to say a word of thanks to the Department of Human Services because, you know, they weren't happy about the news either, and they've really done a lot of work to help us figure out other ideas that we can move forward with.
Senator Sharon.
Just one more question. I'm noting, as you said, Senator Berglund, that there's the front-end assessment process through the senior linkage age line of before the person receives the certifications that they can move into this. Is the senior linkage age line able to do that in a timely way so that there's not a backup for people needing to move out of one system into this system, out of the hospital into the nursing home, for example? Because this requires that that be completed before they can be transferred, correct?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, the fiscal notes, if you look at them, do have a fairly good investment in senior linkage line for adding staff.
Any additional questions or comments from the committee? Senator Rosen.
At some point, are we going to have a chance to hear from the industry as far as I'm wondering if they think I think the assessment is a great idea for everybody, but is that an extra cost? I'd like to know what they're thinking about that. And also if the $1,200 for the elderly waiver per month is adequate and where it sits as far as
Senator Berglund
and Senator Rosen, this figure is actually higher than what would have been in the governor's proposal by about $200 a month. So we're being a little more gentle here. The screening will be done by the senior linkage line, so it shouldn't be a burden on any care provider. And we have funded it out of the savings here. So, but obviously, part of the reason for putting these proposals out on the table today, all of them,
Additional questions from the committee? Senator Rosen.
I hate to ask you one more time, Senator Berglund. So there's no way we can get federal dollars. We're done. We cannot get federal dollars. This is just.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, if we want to get the FMAP dollars, which have already been factored into the forecast.
Yeah.
We can't do the governor's level of nursing home assessment until the last 6 months of the biennium. And again, that's another reason that, you know, I'm having a little trouble getting to my TAILS target because I did have TAILS savings that won't be here now because we're starting it later. But as you can see, these proposals do have a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're doing the best we can to try and get there.
I don't see any additional questions on this particular amendment. Senator Berglund.
Well, I think that completes the agenda then.
I would just announce that our next scheduled meeting is Monday evening at 6 o'clock p.m. in room 123. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
I get to be in this room. I like this room better. It's a meeting. Now, why was this?